So in this chapter about guarding introspective awareness, you know, we have to remember that the context is that we have generated bodhicitta, the aspiration for full enlightenment. We're developing conscientiousness that sees that in order to fulfill our aim of attaining enlightenment, we need to behave properly, physically, mentally, and verbally. And one of the key elements in our physical, mental, and verbal behavior is to have two mental factors. One is called mindfulness, and the other is called introspective awareness. And so this chapter is called introspective awareness, but it's including mindfulness. And so mindfulness is going to remember what to practice and abandon. Okay, that's what mindfulness does. It knows what are my precepts, what are the actions that I want to do as a bodhisattva in training, what are the things that I don't want to do that are going to take me away from my spiritual goal. Okay? And then introspective alertness, or introspective awareness, that kind of is aware of what we're doing in each moment, and is what I'm doing in accord with what I've set out to practice and abandon. And how am I acting, and why am I acting this way? And is what I'm doing suitable? Okay? So these two work together. The mindfulness remembers what we want to practice and abandon, and then the introspective awareness makes sure that we actually do that in the proper way. Okay, so we're going to continue on. We completed verse 16 last night, so we're on verse 17. Oh, by the way, people were asking me last night about the book, so Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and somebody told me they got the book here in Singapore. I think it might have been at Po Ming Si or at PKS, but it look, okay, well, try Amazon. And then this book I know we did get in Singapore. It's called The Way of Awakening, and it's a commentary. It's a very general, brief commentary on the book by Geshe Yeshe Topton, who is one of my teachers and quite an extraordinary practitioner. So I recommend this book too, The Way of Awakening. Okay, so verse 17. Even those who wish to find happiness and overcome misery will wander with no aim nor meaning if they do not comprehend the secret of the mind, the paramount significance of the Dharma. Okay, so if we want happiness and we want to abandon suffering, the big secret, yeah, the big key to the whole thing is that our mind is the source of our happiness and our misery. So if we understand that, then we have a huge open door to be able to create the causes of happiness and abandon the causes of misery, because we know that it's our mind that creates them. And so remember yesterday I talked about how our mind creates happiness and misery in two ways. One way is in terms of the actions we do now, the karma that we create, and then this karma ripens in the situations we encounter in our rebirth, in our habitual tendencies, in the environment we're born into. So, you know, all of those results come from the actions we've done, and the actions originate in the mind. You know, our body doesn't move, our speech, we don't communicate unless there's the intention in the mind. Then a second way that our mind creates happiness or suffering is in this very moment depending upon what kind of mental factor is manifest in our mind. You know, when intense greed is in our mind, we're miserable right then and there. You know, not only do we create the karma, but we also, right now, we're miserable. You know, when we hold on to grudges and we want revenge, we're miserable. You know, somehow we think that harming other people is going to make us feel better. Huh? How does harming somebody else make me feel better? It doesn't. Actually, it makes me feel worse, because then I have to look at myself and say, oh, I'm a person who rejoices in others' suffering. Yikes, do you want to think of yourself as a person who rejoices in others' suffering? I don't want to think of myself that way, so I better not rejoice in that way. Okay? So you can see, you know, right away how the mind can cause happiness or suffering. And in a similar way, you know, when our mind is in a relaxed mood, when we can look at others with an eye of kindness, then our mind is happy. Yeah? People may not always do what we want, but we can still look at them with an eye of kindness. And that makes the mind happy. Whereas when we have the eye of picking faults and being critical, then whatever somebody else does is wrong. Have you ever watched your mind get into that kind of state about somebody? Just this kind of intense, like, I can't stand this person. And so even they inhale, it's like, oh, it's driving me crazy. They breathe too loud. You know? Everything the person does, we're critical of. And sometimes this person happens to be the person you're married to. Then you really have troubles, don't you? Yeah, because this is a person that you married because you thought they were wonderful, and now your mind is playing a big trick on you and just criticizing this person up, down, and center, and making yourself very unhappy and making them pretty unhappy too. Yeah? But if we change our mindset, then, you know, even that person does the same things, it's okay, we can live with it. We don't have to react so violently. Okay, verse 18. This being so, I shall hold and guard my mind well. Without the discipline of guarding the mind, what use are many other disciplines? So if I don't guard my mind, if I don't protect my mind and watch what kind of thoughts and emotions are going on in it, I may try to do all sorts of other practices, but I'm missing the boat. Because actual Dharma practice means transforming our mind. So if we don't look at what's going on in our mind, we might chant a million Amitofos, we might do 2 million prostrations, but nothing much is going to change because we're not working with our mind. Then 19, just as I would be attentive and careful of a wound when amidst a bustling, uncontrolled crowd, so I would always guard the wound of my mind when dwelling among harmful people. And the next verse, and if I am careful of a wound through fear of it being slightly hurt, then why do I not guard the wound of my mind through fear of being crushed by the mountains of hell? Okay, so what this means is if you have a wound, okay, let's say you have a big boil on your arm or you have a big boil on your foot and you're walking around Singapore in a very crowded area, are you going to be careful? You bet, because you know that the slightest wrong step, and then, you know, somebody else is going to step on your boil or push you into the side of the building and it's going to hurt. So you're really aware of the potential for suffering, and you're very careful with how you walk, where you walk, what you're doing, because you don't want that boil to get pushed and burst open and get infected and be painful. So in the same way, if our mind is like a wound, in the sense that, you know, anger, ignorance, resentment, jealousy, envy, arrogance, all these negative emotions are there, and these negative emotions have the ability to produce so much suffering, then we're also going to watch our mind and make sure that those negative emotions don't arise and start running the show, because if they do, we're going to be in a lot of misery. Yeah, and in particular, it's talking about being crushed by the mountains of hell. In other words, if we just let our mind roam over and let the disturbing emotions take it over and do whatever they want, we're going to create so much negative karma that we're going to have a miserable rebirth. Okay? So in the same way that we watch our foot or our shoulder to make sure a boil doesn't get hit or, you know, activated or burst open when we're amidst, you know, in a certain environment, then we're going to watch our mind in the same way to make sure that negative thoughts don't take it over and run the show. Okay? So then, verse 21, should I behave in a way, in such a way as this, then whether among harmful people or even in the midst of women, the steady effort to control myself will not decline. Okay? So if we're very mindful like this, then even we're among people who are slandering, people who have unethical behavior, people who are drinking and drugging, we're not going to be influenced by them. Okay. Here in this verse, when it says, even if I'm in the midst of women, it's talking here, the audience, Shantideva's talking to a group of monks. So if the monks are going to be celibate, then they have to be very careful when they're around women. Otherwise, you know, their lust comes up. Yeah. So the whole idea is that if we're very, very careful with our behavior, then our life goes smoothly, and we don't create the causes of suffering. Mm-hmm. It is better to be without wealth, honor, body, and livelihood, and it is better to let other virtues deteriorate rather than to ever let the virtue of the mind decline. Okay, this is a very pointed verse, because what it's saying is that protecting our mind, in other words, protecting our mind from afflicted emotions and wrong views and wrong attitudes, is much, much more important than having wealth, having honor, even having our body, having a good livelihood. Now you're gonna say, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about that. Yeah, protecting my mind is important, but my livelihood is really important. Yeah, it's more important than my mind, and my money is more important than my mind, and my social status is more important than my mind, and my body is very important, and I've got to protect all these things, because otherwise all these horrible people in society are going to damage them and I'm going to suffer. Right? Do you think like that? Hello? Do you think like that? No? You don't value your money and your honor? Yeah? I mean, just look at how sensitive. If somebody cheats us out of $5, we're really mad. Yeah. Somebody criticizes us, we're insulted and offended. Yeah. So we really care about those things like honor and possession and body and, you know, money and things like this. But what Shantideva is saying is actually those things are not so important compared to guarding our mind. Why? Because if we don't have our wealth, we may suffer a little bit this life, but it's only this life suffering, and it's just going to finish that negative karma. Whereas if we let the virtue in our mind deteriorate and create a lot, you know, let the negative thoughts run our mind, we're going to be creating a lot of disturbing karma, a lot of destructive karma that's going to bring suffering for many, many lives in the future. Okay? So that's why Shantideva says this. You know, we might have a little bit of suffering this life, but that's nothing compared to letting our mind just get filled with afflicted mental states and create negative karma, because that's going to result in far greater suffering for a longer time. Okay? So Shantideva is switching our perspective and saying, don't look so much at the short term of the benefit of this life, look at the long-term effects. Yeah, because this life's important, but it also doesn't last forever, does it? And we all know it's going to end. Yeah, so we shouldn't worry so much about this life. You know, chill out, relax a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's American slang. Chill out. In Singapore, it's actually very practical. We should chill out. It's too hot here. Okay, verse 23. Oh, you who wish to guard your minds, I beseech you with folded hands, always exert yourselves to guard mindfulness and alertness. So here Shantideva is putting his hands together, folded hands, is Anjali, putting the hands, your palms together. And Shantideva is requesting us, as people who want to guard our minds, if we really are serious about this, then we need to practice mindfulness and introspective awareness, what he calls alertness here. So remember, mindfulness holds in the mind, it remembers what to practice and what to abandon. So mindfulness is going to remember, oh, I don't want to kill, I don't want to steal, I don't want to, you know, have unkind or unwise sexual relations, I don't want to lie, I'm not going to take intoxicants, I want to protect life, I want to protect people's property, I want to use sexuality wisely and kindly, I want to tell the truth and speak in a pleasant way to others. I want to keep my mind clear, my body healthy. Okay? So mindfulness remembers all of those things. And then introspective awareness kind of keeps an eye on what we're doing. And, you know, am I really living in accord with, you know, what I've set out to do? So introspective alertness is, or introspective awareness, it's going to watch, like, what are we doing? Like, okay, like, let's say with mindfulness, I think, I don't want to lie, you know? I want my words to be truthful so people can trust me. I want to be an honest person, so I don't want to lie. So mindfulness holds that, okay? Then I'm at work, and I'm talking to a bunch of people, and everybody's telling stories, and I have a really good story, and I can kind of embellish it to make it even a better story. Yeah? Do you ever do that? You know, just embellish a few details here or there, just to make it a better story. But introspective awareness is going to look and say, if you do that, you're not going to be telling the truth. You're going to be exaggerating. You're going to be making up stories and trying to deceive somebody. Okay? So introspective awareness looks and says, okay, you know, what are you saying now? What are you saying? How are you saying it? Are you saying it in a nice tone of voice? You know, why am I saying this? Now, there's the thought in my mind that I want to embellish this story because then everybody will think I'm so interesting because I tell such a good story. And no, I'm not going to do that because I really value being honest with my speech. Okay? So that's how mindfulness and introspective awareness work together to keep us on track. Or another example, let's say you see that it's, you know, drinking is not very good. It's not good for your health. It's not good for your mind. You say and do all sorts of things you regret later on after you've gotten intoxicated. So you have the mindfulness that says, okay, I'm not going to get intoxicated. I'm not going to even take one drink because I want to keep my mind clear. Then you're at a party. Then other people are drinking. Somebody says to you, come on, have a drink. And you start to say, I'll just have some fruit juice. And you say, I don't want to say that. That person's going to think I'm prudish or weird or something like that. I should drink just like everybody else is drinking. Okay? So you're on the verge of doing something that you've already decided you don't want to do. So then if you have strong introspective awareness, it comes up at that time and it says, you sound like a teenager that's very concerned with what your friends are going to think about you. I thought you were an adult who made your own decisions based on wisdom. We talk to ourselves that way. Because our mind that wants to drink just because everybody else is drinking, it's really like the mind of a teenager. And you all tell your teenagers, don't drink just because other people are drinking. You have your own mind. You do what's right. That's what you tell your kids, isn't it? Then you're in the same situation. What do? You act like a teenager. Yeah. So are your kids going to follow your advice? No. They're going to follow the example of what you're going to do. Yeah. But your introspective awareness is going to save the day. Because it's going to come in and say, we're not drinking because we remember that when we drink, we say things that we regret later. We do very silly, stupid things. I'm not going to do that. Okay? And then we just refrain from drinking. And other people forget about it. They have better things to do than to think all day and night that we didn't have a drink. Yeah, we're so funny. We're so concerned what other people think about us, as if they have nothing else to do during the day but think about us. You know, that I'm at a party and I don't drink, and so all these 30 other people for the next week, that's all they're going to think about is about how I didn't drink at the party. A little bit self-inflated, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, let's face it, they're too busy thinking about themselves. They're not going to think about us. Yeah, so let it go. Okay, verse 24. People who are disturbed by sickness have no strength to do anything useful. Likewise, those whose minds are disturbed by confusion have no strength to do anything wholesome. So when you're sick, when you're disturbed by sickness, it's hard to do anything useful. When you have the flu, you just sleep. Yeah, hard to do anything. Yeah. So in the same way, when our minds are disturbed by confusion, it's very difficult to do anything wholesome. It's very difficult to create virtue because our mind is too confused. Okay? So what is this kind of confusion that makes it difficult to create virtue? It's the confusion that can't discern what to practice and what to abandon. What is a virtuous action? What's a non-virtuous action? It's like our mind is just full of fog. Yeah, kind of like today, you know, all the pollution. That's from what, fires in Indonesia? Yeah, so like, it's like our mind is filled with all the smoke from the fires in Indonesia, and our mind can't think clearly. Yeah, we can't see clearly. So in the same way, that's what confusion is like. We can't see clearly. We can't make good decisions. So it's very difficult to do anything virtuous. Okay. So to get rid of that kind of confusion, having a daily meditation practice is really useful. Yeah, because sitting down and practicing every day really helps us familiarize our mind with the Buddha's teachings. Doing some Dharma reading, some reading in a Dharma book each day, again, familiarizes our mind with things. It gives us some virtuous topics to think about. And so that's going to be very good, and it's going to help clear away a lot of this confusion in our mind. And without confusion, then we'll be able to do wholesome things. Whatever has been learned, contemplated, and meditated upon by those whose minds lack introspective awareness, just like water in a leaking vase, it will not be retained in their memory. Okay, if you have water in a vase and the vase leaks, you're losing everything. Okay, so this verse is saying, if we have a mind, you know, and we're learning, we're contemplating, we're meditating, but we don't have introspective awareness, then everything we're learning and contemplating and meditating is going to flow right out of our mind. It's not going to stick in our mind, just like the water flowing out of that pot that has a hole in the bottom. Okay. So it's what he's emphasizing here is this is why introspective awareness is so important. It's going to plug the holes in our mind so that what we learn and what we think about, what we meditate on, can remain vivid in our mind. And then every day we can increase it, and our virtue and our wisdom increases day by day. Even those who have much learning, faith, and willing perseverance will become defiled by a moral fall due to the mistake of lacking introspective awareness. So even somebody who's very knowledgeable about the Dharma, somebody with a lot of learning, somebody who has a lot of faith in Buddha Dharma Sangha, somebody who has a lot of willing perseverance, who is inclined to practice, if they lack introspective awareness, they sooner or later are going to break their precepts and they're going to be susceptible to some kind of moral flaw. Okay? And we see this, don't we? We see this happen. Yeah? Sometimes people might be a very, very good practitioner for a while, but then they lose their introspective awareness. They get a little bit too complacent, or maybe they get arrogant and think that, you know, oh, well, my behavior is very good. I'm not going to break any of my precepts. I'm an experienced practitioner. So I don't need to pay such close attention to my mind because my mind's very well trained. So they get a little bit smug, or complacent. And then what happens? Yeah, they don't have introspective awareness. They're not looking at what's going on in their mind. And then whammo, they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. Yeah, and they break their precepts, or they lose the faith of the other people in the Buddhist community, or they lose the trust in their family. They lose their trust, you know, in the temple. And it comes because of not having introspective awareness and not noticing when we get too self-inflated or too smug. Yeah. So I always warn people, because I saw something very early on in my Dharma life. I saw two people who I thought were very, very good practitioners. A monk and a nun who I had a lot of respect for, and they fell in love and they disrobed. And I was horrified and I was shocked and I thought, oh no, they are good practitioners. I'm just a baby nun. What hope is there for me? You know? And I got really scared. But it was a good kind of fear because it made me do a lot of purification and it made me think, you know, I've got to be really, really careful. You know, I've got to be careful because if I'm not, then, you know, what happened to them can happen to me. And so I always tell people, you know, when you're practicing the Dharma, don't ever think, oh, I have that defilement conquered. It's not going to bother me anymore. Don't ever think that, because as soon as you think, oh, that one's under control, then something comes out of left field that you don't expect, and whammo, you know, you do something that you shouldn't be doing, and you wind up in a big mess. And we've seen it happen, haven't we? Yeah, we've seen it happen in the Buddhist community. In the U.S., this is the standard fare of our politicians, sorry to say. You know, U.S. politicians, always one scandal after another scandal. And these people are supposed to be the leaders in society. And we have, you know, this one's off, you know, going to Argentina to meet his lover, having the state money pay his air ticket. And, you know, this one's going to see a call girl, and yet he's also, you know, trying to clean up the state. So people kind of just not behaving very wisely, even though they're public. And why is it? It's because they've lost their introspective alertness. They've gotten too full of themselves, too proud, too thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm just this great person, and so I can do this, I can do that. It's not so bad. Anyway, nobody will find out. Even if they do, I have friends in office, it'll get worked out. Well, in the States, as soon as the newspaper hears about it, your reputation is worms, okay? So I don't know if it's like that in Singapore, but, you know, this is what happens in my country, unfortunately, you know? And so it becomes, you know, it happens because people they lose their introspective awareness. So we've got to be very careful, seeing that kind of mistake can be made by other people, then we shouldn't be overly confident, but always remain very humble and always think, you know, I could make this mistake too, so I've got to be careful, you know? And then if we're careful like that and we're humble, we're not going to make any mistakes. Okay. The thieves of unalertness, the thieves of lack of introspective awareness, in following upon the decline of mindfulness will steal even the merits I have firmly gathered so that I then shall proceed to lower realms. So the lacking introspective awareness, you know, that mental factor that is the opposite of introspective awareness is like a thief, and it steals away our virtue. And it arises when our mindfulness declines. Yeah, when our mindfulness about what to practice and abandon isn't so strong, then we begin to lose our introspective awareness. And then our mind, the afflictions will arise in our mind and will destroy our virtue, which in turn will lead us to an unfortunate rebirth. Okay, so how does our virtue get destroyed? Two things destroy it. One is anger, the other one is wrong views. So we may spend a lot of time, you know, doing virtuous actions, practicing generosity and ethical conduct and fortitude and love and compassion. We may do so many virtuous things. But then if we aren't careful with our mind and we get really, really angry, that anger is like fire that burns up our virtue. Or if we generate wrong views and we start thinking, oh, karma doesn't exist, or enlightenment doesn't exist, or, you know, some kind of wrong view like that, that burns up our virtue. So it's very serious because we, you know, when we create virtue, we put energy into it, don't we? Yeah, and we put energy and we feel good about it and we want to protect it. And so we dedicate it, yeah? But even if we dedicate it, it can still get destroyed by anger and wrong views if we lack introspective awareness. So that's really saying how important it is, yeah, to always monitor what we're doing, to always look at what am I doing, how am I doing it, am I doing what I should be doing right now? Okay? This host of thieves, who are my own disturbing conceptions, will search for a good opportunity. Having found it, they will steal my virtue and destroy the attainment of life in a happy realm. So the thieves, yeah, are this lack of introspective awareness and all these disturbing preconceptions and thoughts and emotions in our mind, like our judgmental mind or this critical mind or the mind that likes to pick faults in people or the greedy mind that always wants more, always wants better, always is dissatisfied, yeah? That if we let those kind of mental states into our mind and let them run the show, then, you know, they're gonna be like thieves looking for a good opportunity to steal away our virtue. And in that way, they're gonna destroy the possibility for us having a happy rebirth. So this is why we need to guard our mind, okay? So do you see how Shantideva's really emphasizing one major point, but coming at it from so many different angles? Mm-hmm. Therefore, I shall never let mindfulness depart from the doorway of my mind. If it goes, I should recall the misery of the lower realms and firmly reestablish it there. So I'm not going to let my introspective alertness go. I'm not going to let my mindfulness go. But if they do go, you know, because I'm not paying attention, I'm going to immediately, you know, bring them back into my mind. Okay? I'm not going to let my mind keep on with these negative thoughts. And how am I going to bring them back into my mind? I'm going to remember the disadvantages of the afflicted thoughts. Yeah? And one of the disadvantages is that it leads me into a very miserable rebirth. So if I remember that, you know, that gee, you know, my anger is more dangerous to me than it is to anybody else, because my anger is going to take me into a horrible rebirth. Therefore, you know, if I notice that I've forgotten my mindfulness and introspective awareness, I'm immediately going to call them back because I don't want my anger to take over. Mm-hmm. Harsh words, you know, maybe we throw something. I mean, in families, people do this, don't they? Yeah, you lose your temper, you throw something, you do all sorts of stuff. Then how do you feel afterwards? Yeah, you screamed at people, you threw things. Do you feel good afterwards? Or do you feel kind of ashamed of yourself? Yeah? So we have to be careful about this. Yeah? And especially if you have kids. Yeah? Especially if you have children. You know? If you lose your temper and you start, you know, throwing things or hitting people or doing all sorts of stuff, then what is that? What kind of example is that for the for your children? Then you're teaching your kids that it's okay to go out and hit somebody, and it's okay to swear at people and say horrible, mean, cruel things to people you care about. Is that what you want to teach your kids? I don't think so. Yeah? So we have to be very careful. Because kids really look at the example of how their parents handle things. Yeah. My mother used to say, do as I say, not as I do. But you know what? Kids don't do that. Yeah. You watch what somebody does. So you have to, you know, as parents. You know, so often parents come to me and say, oh, my children this, my children that, this kind of problem, that kind of problem. Can you fix my kid? You know? And I always say, well, you know, it also depends on how you're acting as parents. Because kids are going to copy the way they see you deal with situations. Hmm? Okay, next verse. Through staying in the company of spiritual masters, through the instructions of abbots and through fear, mindfulness will easily be generated in fortunate people who practice with respect. Okay, so if we want our mindfulness to arise and stay firm, what kind of environment do we need to put ourselves in? Okay? We need to stay with our spiritual teachers. Yeah? Because like we were just saying, I mean, we become like the people that we hang around. So if we want our mindfulness to increase, if we want our behavior to improve, we have to be around our spiritual teachers. So we have to attend teachings. Or even if we can't attend live teachings, watch them on the web. Go to your Buddhist center. Practice together with other practitioners. Be around Dharma people, okay? Through listening to the instructions of abbots and Dharma teachers, you know, you're listening to teachings. You're discussing them with your friends. You're getting a lot of input from outside about how to train your mind and what is virtuous, what is non-virtuous. So if you put yourself together with these kinds of people, then your mindfulness will become very strong, okay? Because you're with people who have good mindfulness. If you hang around people who drink and drug, what are you gonna do? You're gonna drink and drug after a period of time. If you hang around people who don't have good business ethics, then pretty soon your business ethics are also going to slip and slide. So that's why it's saying, you know, be in the company of our spiritual masters, listen to teachings, go to the temple, go to the Dharma Center. Yeah, surround yourself by good people, and that will make your own mindfulness and introspective awareness strong. Okay, so that's one thing to do. Then verse 31, it says another thing to do, which is to think, I am ever dwelling in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are always endowed with unobstructed vision. By thinking in this way, I shall mindfully develop a sense of integrity, respect, and fear, and also through doing this, recollection of the Buddha will repeatedly occur. Okay? So one technique was by staying with good people and taking teachings and so forth. The other one is to think, I'm always in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Yeah, the Buddhas have an omniscient mind. They know everything that's happening right now. The Bodhisattvas have clairvoyant powers. They know what I'm thinking, what I'm saying, what I'm doing. Do I want to have a mind filled with all sorts of garbage if I'm in the presence of a holy being? If Buddha walked in this room, would you want to have a mind full of garbage? You would want to have a pure mind, wouldn't you? If you were angry and jealous and Buddha walked in this room, would you continue to cultivate your anger and jealousy, or would you really try and just drop them? You'd try and drop them, wouldn't you? Okay. So by recognizing that the Buddhas are omniscient and that they know what's going on in our minds, to really think that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are here, and so thus to try and keep a very positive mental state. Yeah. Okay. And by thinking in this way, we will develop a sense of, here it says shame, but actually the word means personal integrity. So I will, by thinking in this way, we will develop our own integrity that says, I don't want to do negative actions because I respect myself. And we will also develop respect and consideration for others by thinking, I don't want to let my mind be overrun by defilements because I care about how my behavior influences other people. And I don't want to influence other people adversely and make them lose faith in the Dharma or cause difficulties in their minds. Okay? And then it talks about having fear. Here it doesn't mean panicked fear. Here it means an awareness of the downside of creating negative karma, an awareness of the possibility of being born in the lower realms if we don't pay attention to our actions. Okay? So that's another way to think. So very helpful, you know? Even when you're alone, if your mind is starting to get all churned up, oh, I'm so mad, I'm so angry, I want to think of the exact right thing to say to that person to really hurt their feelings, you know, I want to find a way to so they get hit by a truck, you know. You know, kind of really horrible thoughts. We have them sometimes, you know. And then to think, oh, the Buddha's here right now watching me think like this. Ooh, I don't want to think like this in the presence of the Buddha. I respect the Buddha. I love the Buddha. Yeah, I don't want to have such a garbage mind in front of somebody that I respect and love. So drop that anger, drop that revenge. I don't want them. Okay? When mindfulness is set with the purpose of guarding the doorway of the mind, then alertness will come about, and even that which is gone will return. Okay? So when mindfulness, when we have strong mindfulness, remembering what to practice, what to abandon, and we're guarding, you know, our mindfulness is guarding the doorway of our mind to see what goes in our mind, what comes out, yeah? Then alertness, then introspective awareness will automatically come. Yeah, when we have mindfulness, then introspective alertness joins it very soon. They're kind of like a couple, yeah? So, and even if our alertness has gone, it will return when we rejuvenate our mindfulness. Okay, so this is a good breaking point for the evening. We've completed up to verse 33. So tomorrow, the upcoming verses that are coming are verses I really like. So we'll do those tomorrow. So there's some time for questions. I see there's already a pile of questions here. You beat me to it. So I'll start with these, and then if you have other ones, you know, you can ask from the floor or, right. Okay. Is it true that if a non-Buddhist commits a crime, say robbery or adultery, he or she has less negative karma, cause and effect than a true Buddhist practitioner? Wrong. Okay? Doesn't matter you're Buddhist or non-Buddhist, those kind of actions are negative. Okay, and the strength is going to be the same if all the other factors are the same. Okay. I have a relative who has committed adultery for as long as 15 years. Does he have the same negative karma as compared to those who have committed the same action but only for 2.5 years? Thank you. Well, I would say that somebody who's done it for 15 years has much more of habitual karma to do it. And so by the force of that habit of doing it repeatedly again and again and again, it's going to be much heavier. However, having an adulterous affair for 2.5 years is also giving you plenty of time to become very familiar with the negative action. Thank you. Okay, the question is about lying. What if the truth is going to start a war? I think we have to look in situations where we're tempted to lie and see what is the action we did in the first place that we don't want anybody to know about, that we feel we have to cover up. Because you see, this is the tricky thing with lying. Lying is double jeopardy, because first there's something you did that we shouldn't have done, that we don't want other people to know about. So there's one negative action to start with. Okay. Then, because we don't want anybody to know about it, we lie. So then we have a second negative action. Then what happens is somebody finds out that we lied, or somebody finds out that we did the first negative action, and then we have so much trouble because there's two negativities that we did. So we need to not do the actions that are such that we don't want anybody to know about them afterwards. In other words, let's not do negative actions to start with, because if we don't, then we won't have to lie to cover them up. Okay? So in this kind of question, you know, boy, lots of questions. In this kind of question, you know, what if telling the truth is going to start a war? We have to look at, well, what did I do in the first place that I don't want somebody else to know about? Because if telling the truth is going to start a war, I did something at the beginning that probably wasn't so good. So I need to not have done that. Yeah, and I need to repair that action. Okay. Now, does that mean that every time somebody asks you any question, you tell them everything, the whole long story with all the details? No, it doesn't mean that. Okay. And it doesn't mean that if somebody is coming and says, "Where's that person? I want to kill him." You say, "Well, he's right over there." You know? No, I mean, be sensible. Yeah. We're talking about lying that is for our own personal gain. But really look at what you did that you want to lie about it. And be careful of those things, because that's what gets us in a lot of trouble. What do we do if we're faced with office politics, such as unfair treatment or even being wrongly accused, and our supervisor does not even want to listen to our explanation? Actually, we're coming up with some verses about that, or that can be applied to this situation. You know, sometimes if your supervisor doesn't want to listen, you need to let things chill out a little bit, let things calm down, and then go in and talk to your supervisor. You know, we have to be sensitive to timing. Timing is very important. And when a situation is very hot and flared up, sometimes trying to explain something else, nobody else can hear us. We have to wait until people calm down. Okay. And unfair treatment and office politics, you know, everywhere you work, they're going to happen. So the idea is, from our side, to be as kind as we can to other people in our office, to be as honest as we can with not only our supervisor, but with other colleagues, and to just act with a sense of integrity. And if we do that, then hopefully we won't get caught in the midst of office politics. But if we talk behind other people's back in the office, if we scapegoat and tell bad stories about other people, then we shouldn't be surprised when we get involved in office politics and other people turn against us. It's very natural, because look at the way we spoke and talked. What's the definition of bodhicitta? It's the aspiration to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That's the definition of bodhicitta. How do we remove the negative imprints on our mind and keep the positive ones? This is something we're going to go into in the retreat over the weekend, okay? Because this involves the whole practice of purification and the practice of rejoicing. And in the retreat over the weekend, the retreat Skies of Merit, then we're going to be talking about seven practices: bowing, making offerings, confessing or purifying, rejoicing, requesting, requesting our teachers to teach, requesting that the Buddhas to remain in samsara, and dedication. And so those seven practices are very, very powerful, and especially the one about purification we'll be going into in depth. So just to outline briefly, purification involves four opponent powers: regret, repairing the relationship, making a determination not to do it again, and then some kind of remedial behavior. So come on the weekend. This is an advertisement. Okay? So because on the weekend, then I'll have the time to explain it in more depth, and then we'll also do the meditation, so you'll get some experience doing it. People always think that their views are right. How can we tell if our view is a wrong view? Okay, now we've got to talk about views and opinions. Okay, if we're talking about views, we're talking about views, let's say, about the nature of reality, the nature of the path, how things exist, views about what is virtue, what is non-virtue, things like that. So those kind of views are, if we have wrong views, it can be very dangerous, because those kind of wrong views can lead us into a lot of negative actions. So for example, if we have the wrong view that karma and its effects doesn't exist, that there's no ethical dimension to our actions, that we can do whatever we want, and as long as nobody finds out about it, we're home clear. You know, if we have that kind of wrong view, then we're gonna do a whole lot of other very unappealing actions, okay? So those kind of wrong views about spiritual matters, it's very important to catch them and to generate right views. So the way to do that is by studying the Buddha's teachings and thinking about what the Buddha said, and then comparing what the Buddha said to what we think, and really trying to follow the logic and the reasoning with which Buddha explained things and why he explained certain views as correct and other views as not correct. So if you learn and you think about things, you'll be able to protect yourself from those kind of wrong views. Now, the other thing is about opinions. Okay, we always think our opinions are right. Yeah. So opinions we have to recognize as being just that, opinions. They're not reality. They're just my preferred way of doing things. And so how do we test if our opinions are right? I think it's always good to not express an opinion too forcefully, because we don't always have all the information in a situation. And so if we come on like a ton of bricks, it's gotta be this way, then, you know, other people are gonna find us a little bit unbearable to work with. On the other hand, if we have an opinion, we can put it forth, but we can put it forth in a gentler way, like, it seems to me like this, this, this. Or how about if we look at it this way? You know, does this kind of idea make more sense if we look at it this way? Or, I had the thought that it's like this. What do you think about that thought? Okay? And so in that way, we present our ideas, but in the manner of being able to discuss them with whoever we're presenting our ideas with, or our ideas to. Okay, and so that's very different than coming on like a steamroller with our opinions that, you know, and you see this sometimes, you know, things are like this and they've got to be like this, you know, and one person just flattens everybody. Yeah, well, that person might succeed in getting their way for a while, but other people aren't going to like them very much. OK? Okay? So with our views, you know, put them forth, discuss them, don't be attached to them, you know? It's an idea, see it as an idea. Somebody else may have a better idea. That's fine. It doesn't mean that we're bad because we didn't have the best idea, you know? Or we may have an initial idea, somebody may build on that, then we say something else, and so in a very collaborative way, we build on each other's ideas and we come up with something very good. And that's quite rewarding when we do that. Okay. Okay, Vipassana is the meditation that helps us create awareness and insight. Is there a meditation method to facilitate introspective alertness? Actually, Vipassana is a kind of meditation that, yes, it's directed towards insight, it's directed towards gaining understanding, it's directed towards perceiving an object clearly, something like impermanence or selflessness clearly. But to do Vipassana meditation, you need to have mindfulness and you need to have introspective awareness. Those are two mental factors that are very important in Vipassana meditation. In fact, they're important in any kind of meditation we do, because in the context of meditation, mindfulness focuses on our object of meditation, and introspective awareness checks up and sees if we're still on our object of meditation or if we've gotten distracted. Okay, so these two mental factors are important for keeping ethical conduct. They're important for developing concentration. They're important for developing wisdom. So in serenity meditation and Vipassana meditation, they're needed in all of those. And so we develop them, you know, in all of those by, you know, constantly renewing our mindfulness. And then, as Shantideva said, then that brings with it the introspective awareness that monitors what we're meditating on or what our mind is doing. Oh, more questions and less time. Okay. Okay, you have a wide experience and have traveled a lot. What are some of the newspapers or publications that you've seen that encourage a more wholesome or balanced outlook? If you're talking about like magazines and things like that, news publications, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah, because I think the press is so often biased. If you're talking about Buddhist publications, there's quite a good one that's published in KL called Eastern Horizons, and I think it's a very, very good Buddhist publication. So I highly recommend that. My reading tends to go with Dharma books. Okay, I think the Buddha has the most balanced view ever. Yeah, maybe not necessarily on the details of current events, but the Buddha will certainly give me a perspective with which to see current events and what's going on. Okay. So this one will be the last question. How do we get out of a situation when we're in the peak of a mood such as extreme anger or sadness? I think, well, first of all, it's better to try and not let our mind get in that extreme of a mood to start with. And so here's where introspective alertness comes in, is if we're able to monitor our mind, then If the anger starts when it's still small, we'll see it arising when it's small, and we'll be able to apply an antidote. The antidotes for anger are in chapter 6 of the book. Okay, we have yet to come to them. So it's always best to prevent extreme sadness or extreme anger from getting so big by being aware of what's going on in our mind and catching them when they're small. However, if we haven't had much introspective alertness and the anger's really big, then it's best to excuse ourselves from the situation. You know, and just say, look, I'm really upset right now. I need some time to cool down. I'll come back and talk to you a little bit later. Yeah. Because trying to stay in the situation when we're really angry, we're probably just going to wind up saying or doing something that we regret. Okay. With extreme sadness, again, let's not let our mind get to a place of extreme sadness. We always need to, I think of the goodness in the world, and this is why the practice of rejoicing is so important, and the practice of dedicating our merit, because then we remember that there's so much goodness in the world. You know, there's goodness in us, there's goodness in other people. When we remember that, then our mind doesn't go down, it doesn't get overwhelmed with sadness. Okay. Then, okay, how many of you have this little card with Star Spangled Compassion? Do you have it? So, somebody was asking me yesterday how to chant this, and I have to explain to you the origins. These are actually verses extracted from chapter 10 of Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And one day at the Abbey, we were sitting around the kitchen table, and we wanted to have a melody for this. And I don't know how it happened, but we wound up discovering that the words could fit to the melody of the U.S. national anthem. Okay? So our national anthem is Star Spangled Banner. And if you've ever listened to the lyrics of the American national anthem, it is an extremely violent song. Seriously, you know? It's so violent. It's talking about bombs bursting in air and destroying the enemy. And after all these bombs bursted in air and we'd killed all these people, our flag was still there. Really, listen, with all due respect for my own country, I wish we had a different national anthem, you know? So at the Abbey, we wanted to purify that melody, and so we put these verses to it, okay? So we can sing it to the melody of the U.S. national anthem. You can also recite it in a plain voice, and one day we'll think of another melody too that's a little bit kind of more relaxed. But I'll do the one with the national anthem. A couple of you out there in the audience know it and can join me. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and other delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May all who are ill or injured quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other for as long as space endures and as long as living beings remain. Until then, may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. So like I said, we'll also come up with another melody that's more serene. But you know, for those of us who want to purify the energy, you know, of a violent song, this is a very good way to do it. Okay? And these are beautiful verses, aren't they? Yeah, these verses are so inspiring. And so, you know, even if you don't chant them, if in the evening you sit and read them and dedicate all your merit in this way, it's so wonderful because they just, you know, fill you with a good feeling. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.